But also most people have this idea that the stock market is all about liquidity, money printing.
Yeah.
So I know you have some information about liquidity that actually is useful, not just in the context of the stock market, but in all of these discussions.
Yeah.
Because people have, well, it's understandable why they have various ideas about liquidity, because nobody ever defines the term. What is liquidity? It's basically anything you want it to be. It's the Fed printing money. It's, you know, it's Elon Musk buying up some companies. It's whatever, but liquidity actually is something specific. And Alf, I know you've got a bunch of information to share with us about. Let's talk about liquidity.
Yes, let's do that. So I have to say that the most beautiful definition I heard about liquidity was from my friend Dario Perkins, who literally just said, Alf, liquidity is the difference between where people said the S&P 500 is going to be and where it is today. So that difference
in both directions,
is,
right?
I love the definition. But okay, so I want to start with the most misleading chart in macro, the most misleading one. So this chart is just wrong, but I'm going to show it anyway. This chart shows the three largest central bank balance sheets in the world in dark blue, and then it shows the Nasdaq in light blue. And by looking at it, most people will say, look at this amazing correlation, which, by the way, you're looking at like 14 years. So how can you derive any correlation just by looking at two lines going up on a chart for 14 years? But okay. And then, for example, some strategists would say, oh, look, the Nasdaq is going up, but central bank balance sheets are going down. This is wrong. Something must happen. These two series are correlated. The Nasdaq has gone up because central banks have printed money. Okay, that's the story that we hear all the time. So first of all, we should define what the hell is money. So what I did here is...
Good luck with that.
Well, okay, that's a long story, but let's define what liquidity is at least, okay? Or what people often refer to as liquidity.
Yeah.
So I took for you the Federal Reserve balance sheets, good old way, assets and liabilities. You can't miss it, okay? And in blue and in red, I highlighted a few important items. So on the asset side, you will find securities held outright. Well, those are the bonds that the Federal Reserve has purchased under various programs, okay? It's a ton of them. There are still $7 trillion worth of bonds on the Federal Reserve balance sheet. You will find mortgage-backed securities and notes and bonds and so on. Bank term funding program, something we learned recently, right? They figure out this new way to basically backstop the liquidity crisis of 2022 in banks. So I highlighted a few of them, including the stock of gold that the Federal Reserve has. Those are all the assets, okay? Then the liability side of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. Well, there is currency in circulation. There is the reserve repurchase agreement. This is the RRP, the famous RRP, where money market funds park money there. I don't want to go through because I see Jeff, like, I would like to explain all of this all at once, and probably you already have a few times, but the Treasury General Account, and then finally we go into the red part. Reserve balances with Federal Reserve banks, $3.5 trillion. Okay, you see this red part here? That's what people call liquidity the whole time. So it's not some magic formula. It's not something you cannot measure. You can. You just go on the Federal Reserve website, you download this thing, which is a weekly report. It's a balance sheet of the Fed, and you'll be able to see whether reserves at the Fed have gone up or down. And now, the thing is that we should go for a second and explain who prints reserves and how, because the only entity that can print reserves out there is the Federal Reserve. They're the only one that can increase their balance sheet or decrease it. They decide that, right? The most famous way to print liquidity is quantitative easing. So if you imagine a balance sheet of the Fed and of a bank, let's say JP Morgan, before QE, so please look at the left side of this chart only. Well, a central bank will have some assets and will have some bank reserves, and JP Morgan will have, well, some reserves, some loans or other assets, and they will have some bonds as well, right, on the asset side. And on the liability side, JP Morgan will have a bunch of deposits, some of them from us, the private sector, some of them from PIMCO, a pension fund, some other financial institutions. Good. Now the Fed decides to print liquidity magically. So what they do is they increase the balance sheet size, right? They produce new bank reserves. They just digitally, literally, they put some digits in a computer and they say, all of a sudden, we have new bank reserves. They have printed liquidity, quote unquote. They will go and buy bonds with it, right? And now you look at what happens on the JP Morgan balance sheet. And after QE, the bonds which were here have disappeared because, well, they ended up on the Federal Reserve balance sheet, right? And in exchange, JP Morgan has gotten the newly created bank reserves. What has happened? Just think about it for a second. What has happened to JP Morgan? Well, the balance sheet hasn't gone up. It's the same size. Look at the height of the stocks here. What has happened is that the composition of their asset side has changed. They have less bonds and they have a bunch of bank reserves. Okay, now, here is the part that I get pissed off the most about. I would like to understand how people draw a line between this, which is literally mechanically what happens, and more reserves push up the stock market. That is mechanically not possible for a very simple reason. Reserves are used from banks for basically two main reasons. The first is to transact with each other. So Jeff is CD, I am JP Morgan. We'll have some transactions with our clients on the background. We'll have to settle. We both have a reserve account. Instead of exchanging cash, we'll send some reserves to each other. Just money for banks, basically. And we are exchanging money from bank to bank. Or we're having a repo transaction. And I'm going to settle with Jeff in bank reserves. That's it, really. If I want to lend you guys reserves, I cannot. Like, you don't have a reserve account. You don't. Jeff is Citigroup. He has. I'm JP Morgan. I have. You are Joe, a private person. You don't have a reserve account. So I can't lend you reserves. That doesn't work. Okay.
Or Walmart or Amazon. No company. I mean, you can't use them.
There is no direct pipe that links money for banks reserves to money for the private sector. There is no pipe. You can't make it up. You can't receive reserves. Mechanically, it doesn't work. The other thing that people tell me is that, yeah, okay, Alf, maybe I understand that, but the reserves can find their ways into financial assets, right? So they can prop up the stock market. Okay, the only thing that two banks can do with the reserves, again, is trade with each other. And what is that banks trade with each other? Well, they do repo, they settle, and maybe they trade bonds with each other. It could be they trade bonds with each other, right? So what are we doing here? Is we are taking the reserves and we're exchanging reserves between banks, trying to bid each other bonds from each other. But do you understand it's a closed system? It's a closed system in the treasury market, in the repo market, and within reserves. Stocks are not part of this system. Why? Because the regulator has said, well, you guys must own a high quality liquid asset buffer. Okay, all banks must own that. It's a new regulation after the great financial crisis. And do you want to guess what the regulator said? It's an eligible asset for the liquidity coverage ratio, which is the ratio between high quality liquid asset and a potential stressed outflow of deposits. Well, the level one assets are cash, central bank reserves, or securities issued by sovereign. So basically, the government is saying, okay, you guys can own reserves or you guys can own treasuries, pretty much. And those two, from a regulatory standpoint, will be both accepted. And you can exchange them for each other. You know, I sell reserves and Jeff buys treasuries and vice versa. Did I mention stocks? Did I mention the Nasdaq? Did I say that reserves can flow into the Nasdaq and send it to the moon? No, because the Nasdaq is, let's say the stocks underlying the Nasdaq are in most cases not even eligible as a high quality liquid asset. If they are very strict set of conditions, the equity market share of high quality liquid asset is negligible. It's not even 1% of the entire high quality liquid asset buffer. So guys, it's a long story, but just to say, reserves are what you often refer to as liquidity. The central bank prints these reserves via expansion of their balance sheet, mostly quantitative easing. Banks receive reserves. They do not lend them to you. You can't receive them. It's impossible. Neither to corporates. Same story. These reserves are just tokens for banks to trade with each other, either repo or set transaction, trade bonds with each other. And no, they cannot buy stocks with reserves. Now you know what liquidity is.
A lot of that stuff is not motivated by the central bank programs either. I mean, all reserves really tell you, the balance of reserves really tell you, is what the central bank is doing.
Yeah.
If the central bank is increasing the level of reserves, that just means that's the various programs that it's instituted. It's buying bonds or doing something positive with its balance sheet. Expanding its balance sheet and having this remainder at the end, that's what reserves really are. Conversely, yeah, during quantitative tightening, they're doing the opposite. So reserves really just tell you what the central bank is doing. And it doesn't tell you, they don't tell you what the actual commercial banking system is doing, because commercial banks respond to a whole bunch of stimulus beyond just what central bank policies are. And therefore, while they can reserve, they can use these tokens in an interbank method, it doesn't determine what the banks are going to do, what their behaviors or what actually ends up happening in the real economy.
Yeah, I think a great example is Japan in the early 2000s. Japan performed very rapid quantitative easing. The amount of bank reserves in the Japanese banking system doubled as a result in 7 years. So a solid expansion of the Bank of Japan balance sheet, a lot of bank reserves printed in Japan. If I would now ask an open question to any listener here at the Eurodollar University. We doubled the amount of bank reserves in the system. How much do you think bank loans went up in the same period in Japan? Well, if there was a direct pipe, Jeff, between bank reserves and loans, you would say, well, maybe not doubled, but nearly, or something like that. Well, the answer is that you got to change the sign. Bank reserves doubled, bank loans went down. So please, guys, what is the pipe you're talking about? As Jeff correctly said multiple times, for banks to lend, if you flood them with reserves, but they don't have the right incentive scheme, they don't see the right economic growth, they don't have the right level of yield, they don't see the right credit worthiness from people, they don't see the right regulation and the capital attached to it and the return on equity on their loans, they're not going to lend. You can flood them with reserves. It doesn't matter. That's not part of the incentive scheme of what banks are going to do. An amount of reserves going up or down is telling you what the central bank is doing. But the central bank does not have a direct power to influence whether banks are going to lend more or be more or less aggressive or what their CRO will be doing or their CFO will be thinking. That's completely different.
Yeah, let's bring this back to China if we can here, because are we seeing the same thing emerge among Chinese banks? Forever, the central bank, the People's Bank of China and the Chinese banking system were simpatico. If the People's Bank of China wanted banks to do something, they were only too happy to do it because it was expanding their balance sheet. And there was you know, a whole lot of commonality between the policy goals and what banks were doing. They were all going in the same direction and usually at the same speed. But now we're into this, and I agree with you, Alf. I think there's a lot of evidence for a balance sheet recession, if not worse. Now banks are starting to resist. The People's Bank of China over the last couple of years have said, okay, we're doing more stimulus here, especially the last 6, 7, 8 months.
Yeah,
the amount of liquidity going through the MLF and some of the other lending programs of the central bank have gone way up. But yet, banks' credit isn't reversing, but credit has slowed way down in the Chinese banking system. So, are we seeing the Chinese banking system start to become more like Japan or the Western banking system?
I think so, although with a pinch of salt always, Jeff, because China's a centrally planned economy. So at the end of the day, if they really, really want Chinese banks to do something, I guess they have a few levers to make sure that they do.
Yes.
Nevertheless, I would say
I think that was one of the most, you know, you're right, because the policy banks in particular, they're basically government owned and government run.
Yeah, that's correct.
But the policy banks are the ones saying, we're not sure we want to do this right now. Yeah, maybe the government is saying, okay, right now it's a choice, and eventually it won't be a choice. But even the policy banks are taking a step back here.
Yeah, I think it's a very smart point from your side, and that's a signal, I think, that the balance sheet of banks as well is getting damaged by the fact that the collateral value of their loans to property developers or to households that are in shambles because the house prices are going down, you know, the balance sheet health of these banks is moving down, and they don't really want to take more risks in the same sectors. And I think it's a natural reaction during a balance sheet deleveraging episode or a balance sheet recession. That's why, again, I think the only way for Chinese authorities to really forcefully intervene here is fiscal deficits. Just sidestep the banking system completely and go and inject resources into the Chinese private sector. They're not doing that. So I think what they're trying to do, again, is an orderly deleveraging. You know, just manage the downside. Just make sure this thing doesn't completely blow up. But I am not 100% sure that this is achievable, really. And the more I look into it, the more I think that people have become somehow accustomed to this idea that China is weakening. It reminds me of the tale of the frog slowly dying, getting boiled in the water. And, you know, at the beginning, it feels pretty warm and okay, you know, it's just slowing down. And then all of a sudden, the frog realizes it can't jump out of the water anymore because it's losing its energy. And it's a bit, I think it's a good metaphor for China. As people are becoming accustomed to the idea, China is orderly slowing, and, you know, they can manage the downside. But I think the evidence is perhaps that the risks are very much underestimated here.
Yeah, I think, well, we have the great contrast that you just provided us. You've got the banking system doing one thing. At the same time, liquidity is going up in China, or at least it's supposed to be going up in China. And so there's a real lesson here that doesn't just apply to the Chinese situation, that what central banks are doing doesn't necessarily tell you what the eventual outcomes are doing. In fact, I always look at it the other way around. If you see central banks doing stuff, that's usually a warning sign. It means they're responding to something that they're actually seeing in the banking system or in the economy at large or the financial system, whatever the case may be. So the more the Chinese do, the worse you know it is. Not about liquidity. It's about, again, it always comes back to commercial banks.
Yes, I think it's the right way to look at it. And if you want to become more optimistic on China, then you have to hear and see actual fiscal deficits or an actual credit creation that goes on in China. There are no signs of that. There are just signs of Chinese authorities intervening, trying to manage a downside, and they're trying to manage a downside on a $50 trillion worth market. So I wouldn't be particularly positive on the odds they're really able to deliver an orderly deleveraging.
Yeah, and I think part of it too, Alf, is the politics here, because Xi Jinping has really backed himself into a corner, because he's basically said, this is the way we're going to go. This is the law of the land. I mean, he put his name in the Constitution as Xi Jinping fought with, you know, socialism with Chinese characteristics for under the new era, whatever the terminology is. So I'm not sure he can change course. And even if he did want to, he probably wouldn't until it's way too late anyway, because it would require a complete reorientation of the political structure.
Yeah, that's correct. I think he gave a very important speech a couple of years ago, 2021, if I'm not mistaken, where he talked about a new course for China, a new common prosperity, which was away from excessive leverage in the tech and in the housing market into some sort of a more widespread prosperity mechanism that was supposed to go along with higher wage growth and higher consumption and all of that that normally would define a developed market economy. But honestly, the transition isn't going as planned, Jeff. And I think people are underestimating the risks that the deleveraging isn't orderly at all.
Yeah, well, the problem is that you put it in one of the slides you showed at the beginning, that so much of the wealth of Chinese household is tied up into the one asset that's the real problem here. So even if they really did put an effort into doing this rebalancing, it's the household sector and the house in the property sector is right there in the middle. It's the anchor on everything that China has to do and wants to do.
Yes, when an economy is leveraged 220% of GDP on the private sector side, mostly on one asset, it's really, really hard to imagine how this can be done in an orderly way.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your insights with us. You've got not only the macro fund, you also have a monetary construction course coming up too. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Now, before starting the Macro Compass, I was the head of investment of a large European bank, then quit that job, started my own company. But I've been asked by investors to start basically a macro fund to try and exploit these investment opportunities out there, which is something I'm doing as we speak. So the fund is getting set up as we speak. And if anyone is interested in having a chat, reading the fund memo, getting the material, they can simply send me an email at fund@themacrocompass.com. I mean, the monetary mechanics course is coming up soon, where we're going to be talking in details about not only liquidity, but who prints real economy money, how fiscal deficits work, how the liability side of the Federal Reserve works, or reverse repo, TGA, all the things you heard about the whole time. And you always scratch your head like, I think this is important, but I don't understand how it works. Well, the course explains that step by step. Now, in case you want to be informed over that, I think the easiest way is to subscribe to my Substack. It's free. So every 2 weeks, you only also get an informative email, macro analysis. And I will be announcing when the course is ready there. It's in a few weeks, but we'll put the Substack address as well here below the YouTube, maybe, or in the link. So you can just subscribe and you can remain informed in case you're interested in the course as well.
Huge thank you to Alfonso for taking the time out from all the way in Italy to stop and revisit with us here at Eurodollar University. We spent a lot of time on China, the biggest risk to the global economy and the global system. We also talked about the stock market as well as the one term that gets thrown around when we talk about the stock market, and that is liquidity. What is liquidity? What is it really? What do people think it is? Well, Alf and I spent quite a bit of time unpacking that idea too, but that's part of the conversation That's available, the full conversation available only for Eurodollar University members and subscribers. And if you want to become a Eurodollar University member and subscriber, we are having a spring sale right now. And the spring sale on all of our memberships, subscriptions, we've got the first month free for memberships, as well as the daily briefing, as the deep dive analysis where we go further. We've got great prices and bundles on the deep dive analysis, or putting them all together from one low, low price. So check out our spring sale. Check out the rest of the conversation with Macro Alf. And if you are interested in Macro Alf's macro fund that he's setting up, there's a link in the description to email him for more information, as well as all the links in the description about everything that Alf is up to lately. Again, cannot thank Alfonso enough for coming back and revisiting with us at Eurodollar University. And I hope to see him again pretty soon. So thank you very much for watching and sticking around to the end. Check out the Eurodollar University sale, and we'll see you all again next time. Take